Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast.
Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin. Dub the mic and the piano quite low because today we are talking about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the 8th album by the Beatles, or 14th if you were living in the USA at the time. And what can be said about this album that hasn't been said already? There have been books written about it, there's been documentaries made about it, there's even been a movie made about it, which we're not going to talk about. But I personally think it's underrated and we've all forgotten how good it is, but I would say that. Stephen, are you a Sgt. Pepper fan?
I am a Sgt. Pepper fan.
Oh, good.
That's why I'm here today. Yeah, it's not their best album.
Okay.
It's certainly in the top five.
Okay, so it's in the top tier of Beatles.
Top half.
Something we would probably get into talking about later on is this notion that for a long time, Pepper was the best Beatles album, and we were kind of told it was the best album of all time, period. This was kind of a sacrosanct fact. And that's kind of slipped away in the last, 20 years or so, that other albums have kind of slipped ahead of it. And I think there's a case to be made that it possibly is the best Beatles album.
Well, it's Paul's best album, so I can see where you're coming from.
Okay. But it's also, in some ways, it's kind of a pinnacle of their evolution and their uniqueness.
I think so. I think for me, it's the peak in the sense of their influence, their mastery of studio technique, this idea that they were both reflecting what was happening, that was going on around them in the culture, but also in some way leading the way or pointing the way forward.
Well, they're kind of influenced by themselves on Pepper. You know, they're high on their own supply. They're kind of influenced by the possibility of what can happen. Whereas in the White Album and the later albums, you can kind of point towards, you can see other things influencing them. But on Pepper, it's just like, no, this is them reaching a point almost by themselves.
I think it's, I think in that sense, in one sense, it is a pinnacle. And that after this point, they're sort of moving away from sort of complete dominance of music, of culture, of art, of Western sort of teen youth culture. That it's the moment at which I think that and it's the fact that it comes out in the middle of, in the middle of the year, that this is the point, I think, at which the focus of teen culture starts shifting from swinging London, which, if you think of that phrase, swinging London, I always sort of, there's that clip of Carnaby Street they always use in People Walking, but it's really late 66, early 67 is swinging London, and by the time you get to the back end of 67, it's the west coast of America.
Yeah.
And it's a shift, it's a geographical shift.
Yeah.
And the Beatles, I think, always are still there at the top, pinnacle, but there are other types of music coming in, and we probably get on to this idea about pop music, rock music, and that fracture that comes around this time.
But it does seem quite, to me, it's always quite a joyful or a happy album. I mean, Revolver, people talk about it being kind of a metallic album, or it's quite kind of, it's quite rough and hardened, whereas Pepper is, joy in music is a hard thing to do, and there's a lot of happy things going on in Pepper. And it also kind of exists almost outside of the band sometimes. You can...
I think that's right. I mean, people talk about the Summer of Love, but I think McCartney sort of doesn't use that phrase. He said it was a golden summer.
Yeah.
And there is just something, it captures a feeling. And it, as you say, it's this kind of joyous sound. Revolver is a very clever album.
Mm.
It's a very knowing album.
There's a cynicism to
Revolver.
There is.
There's a kind of, and that's from for me, that starts with Paperback Writer and that song. There's something quite knowing and quite cynical about that, and the B-side, Rain, and that sort of spills over into Revolver. I think you're absolutely right. I think Sgt. Pepper is a very sort of joyful album. It has moments, George always there to...
The conscience.
Well, slightly discordant or slightly not entirely buying into the concept, But yeah, I think it's it has a unifying effect.
Okay, so we're planning to do this will be part one of two parts on Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. So in this first part, we're kind of going to look at the chronology that got them into the studio and that got the album recorded, and hopefully in the second half we'll kind of look at the album as it comes out and its afterlife. So if we rewind back, a lot of people, you know, the big thing about Pepper is that it's the studio album that they said yeah. goodbye to live performances. So you're kind of talking about their last, you know, this kind of starts on the 29th of August in Candlestick Park. The Beatles do their last show. They know it's their last show. The general public don't really know it's their last show. And what's interesting is that they're given a chunk of time off after that gig on the 29th of August, which they all do different things with. And in a parallel universe, you could think, well, you know, Epstein could have said, listen, take 3 weeks off, get yep. in at the end of September, get the Christmas single down. But that doesn't happen. They basically get 3 months off from the end of August to the end of November.
And this is their first period, their first break, their first holiday since the first album, since the first single.
Yeah. You know, they have a bit of a break at the start of 66 when the movie falls through, but that's kind of an accident.
But 3 months, you know, where they're all, they have time, each of them has time to do something else, to embark on another project.
Yeah. And so, you know, to break down those projects, you know, John goes off to Almeria in Spain and he takes on his role in the movie How I Won the War. Ringo doesn't really do a whole lot. He goes out to join John for a bit of time in Spain. George goes deeper into his studies of India and goes off to India itself. Yeah. And Paul does a movie soundtrack with George Martin called The Family Way. And How I Won the War is interesting because it gives John isolation. And in the isolation of Almeria, he starts writing Strawberry Fields.
Yeah. So again, this is... He's completely separate from the others at this point. So he doesn't have McCartney to bounce lines off. And I think Michael Crawford, who's in that film, he talks about, and he has a book, everybody has a book, where he talks about sort of hearing the song develop and hearing very early versions of it, which is just an acoustic guitar and him working his way through.
And we can hear that basic acoustic version on Anthology 2. There's a, you know, that bit where he says, I can't play the chords. But there's definitely the root of the song is there. And so John spends 7 weeks in total in Spain from the 19th September to the 6th of November in and around Almeria. And then he comes back to London. And incidentally, the week he comes back to London is the first time he meets Yoko.
Yes.
And he goes to her, what was that show? That was the You Are Here show, was it?
The Indica, yeah.
Yeah, when he goes up the ladder and it says yes and all the rest. And eventually they get drawn back into Abbey Road and they return to Abbey Road on the 24th of November. So as I said, that's quite a long gap. And it's also important because there's no particular pressure on them. As we said, they weren't asked to deliver a Christmas single and they weren't expected to deliver a Christmas album. And in the background, a collection of Beatles oldies is coming out as a compilation in the UK anyway.
Yeah.
So there will be some kind of Christmas product. But then they go back in on the 24th and they start working on Strawberry Fields.
Yes.
And so the difference, I know we've talked about Strawberry Fields in our AA Sides episode, but what's interesting is this starts a very unusual process of them not getting the version of Strawberry Fields that's satisfactory for them.
Yes, I mean, I think this is really the first occasion in which they completely remake something.
Yeah.
So they come up with the first version. That seems to sort of be okay. They sort of seem all right with that. Then there's a decision, no, we don't like that. And then they remake it. And I think this is the first time that they have completely remade something that they had recorded, where they go back. And again, I think this reflects maybe not perfectionism, but this idea that they can use the studio and the studio becomes an instrument, which is really picking up from where Tomorrow Never Knows, with tape loops and they're using the studio.
And just from a question of timeline, it's worth reminding that the week they go in to start recording Strawberry Fields Forever, it's 4 years since Love Me Do hit the charts. Lennon is 26, Ringo is 26, Paul is 24, and George must still be 22. So that's sobering.
Yes. I mean, it is that if you think, if you listen to Love Me Do and you listen to Strawberry Fields side by side, I mean, that doesn't sound like the same group.
And that's, you know, people talk about what they did in 7 years, but really what they did in 4 years is quite extraordinary. And so they know that they are going to be in Abbey Road and they're kind of working to the beat of their own drum. And between going in on the 25th of November and breaking for Christmas, they spend 10 days in Abbey Road. But they also do an interesting thing that the day after they come back on the 25th of November, they go into Dick James Music and they do Everywhere It's Christmas, the Christmas single.
Yes, yes.
And it's interesting that we kind of think of the Beatles at this time as being very serious and beardy, and but you listen to Everywhere It's Christmas and it still has that kind of fab craziness, lunacy kicking in, you know?
It is. They're still tapping into that. The fans, that's what the fans
want.
There isn't really, I suppose, a sort of an indication there of what's about to happen.
No. But I guess what does happen, apart from them kind of leaving live performance, is that we kind of lose a precious thing from the previous few years, which is the Beatles group interview or the press conference. Mm. This notion of them being together, being funny, being entertaining. They essentially stop doing television and they stop doing four-way appearances.
Yes.
And that's a big loss, I think.
It is. I mean, if you look at the television appearances, we sort of looked at this in a previous episode, sort of around the sort of Christmas episodes. The amount of television that they do, both in terms of straight live performances from that, I suppose that Some Other Guy is what everyone thinks of in the Cavern, and then they're appearing on the Mike and Bernie Winters show, they're appearing on the Morecambe and Wise show. They're doing press conferences, they're doing interviews. Suddenly, television is really what breaks them, and I think particularly in America. Yeah. And they were very conscious of that. And there's almost a point here where they've decided we've stopped touring and we don't need TV anymore. We don't need to do that. Whereas I think those television performances have been very carefully orchestrated by Epstein as part of the campaign to break them in the UK and the US.
But we really see kind of a petering out of the four of them being silly. The only thing I can really think of them doing after this is when they're all dressed as wizards in Magical Mystery Tour, which is kind of a silly, dumb thing.
It's kind of I watched that again recently as part of what we were looking at here. And
it reeks of Paul's idea.
It does. It's very forced. It's not. Whereas the press conferences, in particular, are just it's the interplay and it's the speed, and they're all playing one off against each other. Yeah. And looking at some of those press conferences, Ringo is actually the star frequently. Of those, particularly the American press conferences.
And the press conferences in '66, although they'd been kind of dominated by the Bigger Than Jesus stuff, they're still, even though they're getting old and wise, they're still being played for laughs.
They are, and they're still a group.
Yeah,
there's still that four personalities and that interplay, and they're still being, if you like, marketed or presented, or they're still presenting themselves as a group.
Yes,
and I think that is the shift.
Yeah,
with Pepper.
So back to Abbey Road, pre-Christmas, they spend 10 days in the month before Christmas in Abbey Road, and they do basically four main versions of Strawberry Fields Forever, and we can now hear all those versions between the anthology and the Sgt. Pepper box set. There's the gentle version, the band version, and then there's the two versions that ended up getting edited together for the single. And the only other song they work on that time is When I'm 64. So when they break for Christmas, they've done a month's work and they have these two songs, which is not the most speedy way of working.
It doesn't bear comparison with their previous work rate.
So the last session before Christmas is on the 22nd of December, when they edit together the two versions of Strawberry Fields. So they speed one up, slow one down, find the edit point and put it together. Do you, whenever you hear Strawberry Fields Forever, do you hear that edit every time?
No.
Do you not?
No. I've consciously, because it's such a well-known story and because it's something that I think I deliberately
Okay.
I could find it. I mean, I could pinpoint it for you. But when I try not to, to hear it.
Ever since I read it in Lewison's Sessions book years ago,
it ruined that song.
Here it comes. It doesn't ruin it. It's just part of the fun. Like it's part of the story. So I won't reveal it here. But if you want to go off and you can find where the edit is between the two versions of Sgt. Pepper, go and enjoy yourself. But they. Again, having taken 3 months off, they don't take off a lot of time for Christmas because they're back on the 29th of December. Very important date.
Very important date.
Because at that point, Penny Lane is unveiled on the 29th of December 29th of December 1966. And when do we know when Penny Lane was exactly written? Because Paul mentions something about Penny Lane in 65 in interviews, like he likes the melody of the name.
Yes, I don't actually know when this song comes into being. I mean, there's this notion that in and around the time of Rubber Soul, they're starting to think about writing something about Liverpool or writing something about their childhood, and there's sort of. If you go onto the internet, you can find the original lyric to In My Life, which sort of name checks, you know, the bus stop and the crossroads. And and it's almost like a bus journey. So back in 65, there was this notion of writing something. And I'm guessing that has been kicking around in the background somewhere. Yeah. Why it didn't come out specifically in... in the year or appear on Revolver, I don't know. McCartney has sort of debunked the theory that Sgt. Pepper, the album, was going to be about, specifically about Liverpool or about childhood. And he said, no, that was never the concept.
Yeah. But was Penny Lane kind of forced into existence by Strawberry Fields? Because obviously Strawberry Fields is another part of Liverpool.
Yeah, I think that's the accepted story, is that in response to Strawberry Fields, and it's interesting. They're very, I mean, I know they're double A side, but they are the flip side of each other.
They're so simpatico. It's quite striking.
Yeah, but it's very instructive as to how about the different characters. So you've got Lennon, this sort of slightly odd, discordant, dark take. This sort of sense of isolation. No one is in my tree, and no one thinks like me. McCartney, you have on the face of it a very bouncy, linear description of what's happening in a particular street. But yet, when you look below that, there's very odd things going on in that song, in that lyric.
And it's interesting because it kind of speaks to art in general. Because you've been to Strawberry Fields and you've been to Penny Lane. And, they are not necessarily places that are, they've kind of had something interesting foisted upon them because of these songs. Do you know what I mean? You wouldn't necessarily think of them as being particularly poetic or amazing places.
No, I mean, when I was standing outside the gates of Strawberry Fields, it's a gate.
Yeah.
And, it's a gate. It has resonance because of the song.
Yes.
But it's not something that's inherently inspiring. I mean, it's a point, it's a way in. I nearly said gateway. It's a gateway.
It is a gateway, I suppose.
It is a gateway, literally and metaphorically, to tap into those sort of childhood memories, but I think also childhood insecurities.
Yeah.
I think, always very reluctant to sort of, I'm not a psychologist, but it is very interesting to think, well, what is coming out of that song about those insecurities that seem to be such a key part of Lennon's personality from childhood all the way through.
Yeah. And so if we keep moving on, we get into 1967, and in January 1967, there are 10 recording sessions in all. Again, the it's not a very riotous pace of music, but on January 4th they work on Penny Lane. On January the 5th, though, it's a very momentous day. It's Carnival of Light Day. Carnival of Light, where they spend the day making a 13-minute 48-second sound collage that has become the sort of bane of existence of Beatle fans.
Yes. I don't want to hear this song.
Yeah.
I think it's good to have something that is like a holy grail that you're never going to get.
Yes.
And the sense of crushing disappointment when it finally is released will be overwhelming. I think it actually functions better as a sort of mythical.
Well, it is funny. It's been so long now. And I know that I've seen discussions online. People are like, oh, just release it. And if you don't want to listen to it, you don't have to listen to it. But that's not the point. It's actually become something else. By omission.
Yeah.
It's become a totem for a totally different thing.
I think that's right. I mean, it is this sort of lost, wonderful, magical thing. And despite the fact that, everyone, Mark Lewisohn has heard it, and he not overly impressed. It's sort of noise. I mean, you get little insights into descriptions of people who've heard it saying, oh, it's just chaos, or it's Lennon running around shouting the word Barcelona for some reason. And you think this is not, you know, it has been compared very unfavorably to Revolution Number 9.
Yeah.
Which has a degree of sort of thought or sort of a construct to it. So no, I think it's better unreleased. I think it's a tantalizing thing that we can dream about.
And then as we walk through January, you know, they spend a lot of time on Penny Lane. There's about five sessions, further sessions handed over to Penny Lane. Probably the most famous one is on the 17th of January, where the piccolo trumpet gets dubbed on. Paul has been watching a Bach Brandenburg concerto on the television on the 11th of January and seeing the trumpet, thinks that would be a nice sound for Penny Lane, and then brings in a session player,
Dave Mason,
to get George Martin to put the score down and then try and play the highest note possible on the piccolo trumpet. And then once Penny Lane is completed, the next song they work on is A Day in the Life. And A Day in the Life first appears in the studio on the 19th of January. And it's interesting because when people have done the research, the 4,000 Holes in Blackburn, Lancashire story was only in the newspaper 2 days earlier.
Mm.
So whether, you know, I don't think the song was written 2 days earlier, but it certainly must have only been completed 2 days earlier.
Yes, the lyrics are being refined up to that point.
Yes, and obviously the first verse refers to the Tara Brown crash that we discussed in a previous episode that happened at Christmas 1966. So again, you know, Lennon is bringing in a different type of song to Penny Lane's. You know, he's trying to get to grips with what he would become known for, these kind of deeply personal, reflective songs, these kind of newspaper songs that he describes quite literally, you know.
Well, the Tara Brown crash, that was he had died in December 66, but the inquest was taking place and was being reported around that time in January. So it was the Daily Mail in January, 17th of January, 1967, was the report of the inquest.
And so the 19th and 20th of January are spent getting A Day in the Life down. But then the decision is made, and this is the famous decision, that the two songs are pulled, Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever, for a double A-sided single. And actually, if you look at the chronology, it all happens quite quickly. The two songs are mixed for single on the 25th of January for release in February. And so the next thing the Beatles do is they go off to make their Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields Forever clips. So they're up in Sevenoaks in Kent on January the 31st doing the Strawberry Fields Forever clips. And then on February the 5th and February the 7th, they're in Stratford and Sevenoaks again doing material for the Penny Lane clip. And it's interesting that we think of these things as, you know, a very strident part of the Beatles' history, but it's all happening very quick. It's all quite thrown together. I'm not sure who storyboarded the Beatles' videos at those two videos at that time. They seem to be a little bit ad hoc.
Yes, I mean, sort of this random horse riding through bits of London, and presumably they couldn't get the horses up to Liverpool, to Penny Lane.
I couldn't get the Beatles up to Liverpool at that point. And as I've pointed out before, it does start the trend of people having a four-course dinner in a forest setting in a field, which is a 1967 trope. Go look for it elsewhere. But it means, though, that, you know, things kind of change around this point, because they've been in the studio for 2.5 months, and two of the four songs that they've worked on have been taken away. So they're basically left with When I'm 64 and A Day in the Life, which aren't even finished. And so they've two kind of half-finished songs and still no album. And what's interesting is, you know, for February and March, they really kind of kick into overdrive. And this sort of narrative that the Beatles were carefully crafting everything in the studio, honing away, some songs come out very, very quickly in this period. It's like, okay, we've done the studio experimentation thing, let's just get on with it. And so they start working quite quickly again. And probably, you know, in February, in the 28 days of February, they have 16 sessions. And across February, they'll introduce six new songs in those 16 sessions to the Sgt. Pepper album. And the first one is the Sgt. Pepper title track, of which they start working on the 1st of February. And I guess that changes everything. It gives them something to hang the album on.
I think so. This is where the sort of the concept, the loose concept of the Beatles being not the Beatles, of being something else, and it sort of flows from that. So I think this is the point at which they Paul, and let's be clear, this album is very much dominated by Paul at this stage. You know, he has the notion of a sort of alter ego for the band. He comes up with the title track. He is driving it forward.
Yeah.
He is probably of all being probably about it. He is definitely the one who is closest to George Martin in the studio.
Yeah.
The most interested in the studio production side of things.
And the story goes that he's on a plane with Mal Evans, and Mal Evans, one of them asks to pass the salt and pepper, and Paul says, "Sergeant Pepper."
Sergeant Pepper. And then, yes, Mal doesn't know what S and P mean on the crit set, supposedly.
Oh, really?
Which I don't know. I mean, I think that seems.
Oh, you'd think he'd be a man of the world by that point.
You'd think he'd be a man of the world by that point, but yes, this is supposedly the idea. And McCartney says, "Oh, you know, at this stage, and the Big Brother and the holding company, and
these
kind of fanciful." So he comes up with this idea of Sergeant Pepper, and the idea being, well, that would allow you to write a song for that band.
Yeah.
You don't have to write a song as the Beatles or for the Beatles. You can write a song for this other band, and we can pretend to be somebody else.
And listening to the title track on the box set, you kind of you notice that, first of all, it's striking that they're playing it live, essentially.
Yes.
With a live vocal, because we're kind of told that this album's a studio concoction, but actually they're you know, for a band who are sort of supposed to be post-live, they're playing it live. You know, George's guitar fills are very in tune with the song. He's certainly totally engaged. And it does kind of rock, because I think with the overdubs of the horns and the you kind of miss the band play underneath. And the naked version on the box set makes you realise that actually it's quite a tight little tune.
It is. I mean, I think that was one of the big surprises for me in the box set, was you sort of think, well, if that four piece had gone into the Savile Theatre and played that, they could have given the Who a run for their money. I mean, it's a really kind of hard rock sound that they're playing as the basic track.
Yeah, and you kind of have the Hendrix Cream thing creeping into the sound of London at that time.
And I think that's the thing, it's reflective of that, that this kind of harder
power
edge,
rock kind of thing.
Yeah, this sort of power trio was coming to the fore.
Yeah.
And you sort of have the sense of, always had the sense of Sergeant Pepper being, as you say, very carefully constructed and layered and layered and layered. And obviously that did happen. Mm. And bass parts were wiped and put back on. But the core band, they were a good band.
Good little band. So as we walk through February, you know, A Day in the Life gets Paul vocals and Ringo's drums. Good Morning appears on February the 8th. Fixing the Hole appears on February the 9th, recorded at Trident. So they're working quite quickly. And then on February the 10th, they have the A Day in the Life orchestra recording, which is obviously another pivotal moment. Mm. And again, you listen to the bare bones version of A Day in the Life without the orchestra on the box, and then you listen to it with the orchestra. They must have been very happy with that day's work when they listen back to the tapes at the end of the day.
Yes, I mean, I think this idea of just a sort of cacophony of sound that they had deliberately left gaps to be filled with something.
Yeah.
You get this sort of rather lofty notion that McCartney says at one point about marrying classical music and popular culture.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's reflective of this idea that, well, anything is possible.
Yes.
And if anything is possible, the people who can deliver it are the Beatles.
And it's interesting because when they were recording yesterday, like 18 months or whatever earlier, you know, George Martin had said, "Well, you know, Paul, I think we could put an orchestra on this."
Yeah.
Paul was like, "No orchestras.
No way. Yes.
And now it's like, yeah, let's get an orchestra and let's quadruple track it so it sounds like four orchestras. And if you listen to the orchestral overdub on the box set as well, you can hear, particularly at the end, what you might always appreciate is the first couple of bars of that are scored, the kind of the wavy bits.
Yes.
And then they were told in group to roughly at certain bars hit certain notes,
but
so that they would end on the highest note.
But how you get there is up to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the musicians would kind of look at each other and follow each other. And obviously the recording of that is documented in the A Day in the Life video. So there's lots of the good and the famous
beautiful people,
particularly Michael Nesmith, of course, having deep conversations. That's the best bit, obviously. But then after they record Day in the Life Orchestra on February the 13th and February the 14th, they start recording George's song for the album, which is Only a Northern Song.
The Great Lost Classic.
The Great Lost Classic. Great Lost. So this is George's contribution to Pepper and obviously doesn't end up on Pepper.
Yes.
So let's talk about that.
Well, could we say not only does it not end up on Pepper, it doesn't end up on the Pepper box set.
Yes. Yes.
Which I think that's I know I'm you know, George's advocate here, but it seems to me very odd that that a song recorded right in the middle of those sessions does not end up on the box set.
I would agree with you. I think across the three box sets, you know, they're a little bit inconsistent about what gets on and what doesn't get on. You know, so something like Goodbye gets on the Abbey Road box set. Lady Madonna gets onto the White Album box set. I definitely think Only a Northern Song should have been there because it's a great track. There's some interesting things to hear there. You know, we're not saying it's on Sgt. Pepper, but we're saying it's part of the general...
It's part of the creation of the album.
Yes.
In the same way that Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane.
So it's part of, and it is the only song from those sessions that doesn't make it, isn't it? There's no other song that gets dropped.
No, I mean it's up there with Carnival of Light. It's Carnival of Light and Only a Northern Song. And I wonder, is that a kind of quid pro quo?
So do you think it was the right decision to? Okay, I guess the options are: Pepper comes out and the George song is Only a Northern Song. Pepper comes out and it has two George's songs, Only a Northern Song and Within You Without You, or Pepper comes out with just Within You Without You. What are your takes on those possibilities?
I think they could have squeezed another George song on. I don't think there's another Beatles. There's a Beatles album out there that couldn't benefit from another George song. But but seriously, I don't understand why it was considered lacking in something that sort of musically, I can understand it. Perhaps it is a very sour song. I mean, this is a continuation of George complaining about the songwriting arrangements. It's about maybe it was thought you can't be complaining about your royalty rate. You're really criticizing.
Well, we talked about the album
ourselves.
Being a joyous album,
yes,
and it kind of takes you outside of the Beatles, and it doesn't meet those criteria. It's not really like I love the song, but it's not really joyful, and it's very much about being I am George from the Beatles, and here's my beef.
Yes, it is. but when you read the descriptions about why it didn't get on, it's George Martin saying, "Well, I thought it was a weak song. It was a weak." I absolutely accept it doesn't hit those two main criteria. So from that point of view, I can see why it's not on the album. But
it's got that bonkers Paul bass line. I wonder, did George like that or not like that?
Yeah, I just think this is just a kind of classic Harrison song. It's got discordant things in it. He always had a sort of slightly left field, slightly sour take.
Yeah.
And what he said at the time was he was persuaded. Whenever he started writing, he was persuaded to sign with Dick James to sign up to Northern Songs. Then what happens is they float that company and Paul and John get 15% of the company and George gets 8%. So suddenly he realizes Paul and John are getting more of his songs than he
is. Yes, yeah.
And I mean, at one point, you know, he goes on to give interviews much later in his career about, you know, it was theft, and I was this naive kid that signed up, and basically I was completely ripped off. And he has no time for Dick James whatsoever, simply because he suddenly realizes he's a minority shareholder and he's not getting as much. He writes a song, and John and Paul and other people, the other shareholders, are getting more money than he is.
So possibly, though, I think the better song won out, and we'll come on to Within You Without You in a second. But if we keep on going through February, Mr. Kite appears, and the effects session for Mr. Kite, where they take all these pipe organs, chop them up, throw them up into the air, stick them together and overdub them on to give that lovely circus sound. They finish A Day in the Life. So if you listen to the box set, you hear the original humming ending, which is what they wanted to do, where they just all hum.
Yeah, and that doesn't work.
It doesn't work at all.
It really doesn't work.
But then they realise that they needed the piano chord. So it is interesting that A Day in the Life kind of comes together. We think of it as one big thing, but it comes together in three very separate ideas. And then they record Lovely Rita and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Lovely Rita, I'm going to stop on for a sec because I think that's a really overlooked song.
Love this song.
I love Lovely Rita because I think people think, oh, geez, it's kind of trite. But there's actually a ton of melody happening in Lovely Rita. There's lots of interesting ideas. And there was a clip I saw on YouTube a few years ago, and we can put a link up here on the website or whatever on Twitter, of a guy doing an acoustic guitar cover of Lovely Rita. And you kind of realise that the song has an awful lot of things happening in it in terms of melody and structure and solos and, you know.
It's very Paul.
It is very Paul, and also the kind of the noises, but even the little small details, like where, you know, I got the bill, Rita paid it. Yeah. That kind of stuff, I find, you know, it's a song that has its own inner structure and world. No? Yes?
Yeah, it's one of those songs that I think it's there. It's a yeah. nice kind of uplifting song, but I don't think there's much to it.
Okay.
That's I mean I you know. Yeah, it's one of, you know, I would bracket it. It's like Hello Goodbye.
Okay.
I think it's a kind of, it's an up-tempo, bouncy song. I think it's got a clever lyric. But for all of that, I think it is just, yeah, there was a traffic warden. And
I suppose, okay. I think in terms of arrangement, it's got an interesting arrangement. It's got the acoustics. It's got a very good sense of mixing and echo and, you know, the kind of the vocalizing at the end of it is quite striking as well.
You know that there is a rumor that David Crosby appears on that track.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Well,
tell me more.
David Crosby,
whose memory can be trusted 100%.
It can be trusted 100%. David Crosby, I have to say, David Crosby has never claimed to be on that track. But David Crosby was certainly in the studio when that was being done, when the backing vocals were being done. There are photographs in the Beatles book of David Crosby all gathered around a microphone. So you've got Lennon, McCartney, Harrison and Crosby standing around a microphone.
Yes.
So they were doing something.
Yes. Now,
Crosby has never said that he sang on it. He's certainly talked about being there and being blown away by the session. But there is another singer of whom I'd never heard called Sean Phillips, an American sort of folk singer, I think, who was also there that day. And he has given an interview in which he was said, he and David Crosby were told, right, come on, get around the microphone and sing backing vocals. So if anyone can break that down, we can demix that and get a David Crosby or this other chap.
Sean Phillips. Well, let's break down while we're on discussions. We mentioned A Day in the Life and Lovely Rita. Let's talk about who does the as in A Day in the Life. One of the Beatledom and fandom most vexing questions. So the thing we're talking about is somebody spoke and I went into a dream, and then the as that come in after A Day in the Life. And people cannot decide whether it is John or whether it is Paul. And for many years, I just assumed it was John.
Mm.
And I have switched my opinion to actually think that it is Paul. And you've probably helped make me transition over to thinking that it's Paul.
Yeah. Yes, I always assumed it was Paul.
Yeah, I always assumed it was John.
It's odd because they do. I mean, they do have very different voices.
Yes.
But occasionally, there's just where they just seem to be indistinguishable.
Yeah.
But yeah, I always assumed that was the case.
Well, the two things that kind of tipped me over is if you go to the box set and you listen to the original versions of A Day in the Life, John isn't doing that. You hear John's vocals and Paul's vocals are missing.
Yes.
So you think, oh, that's interesting. So maybe this is Paul. But the other thing is that noise that Paul makes at the start of Lovely Rita, where he goes,
And it's like having Paul here.
It is, isn't it? It's that is the same kind of extemporization that you hear in A Day in the Life. So I'm like, oh, that is Paul.
Yes.
That Lovely Rita thing is what made me change my mind.
Okay.
But maybe people can argue with us on
people can
Twitter
write,
and Facebook.
Yeah,
and
send in a postcard.
To W12AQT and tell us what they think. So the album is gathering a pace, and then in March, they really are trying to get the album over the line. There's 18 sessions in March, and they get 5 new songs out. There's also a lot of mixing that starts going on, so they start to try and bring the album together. So the new songs that appear is they finally get down Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, Getting Better, and then Within You, Without You. Within You, Without You is
the best song on the album?
Well, I think it's, I would say, as a teenager listening to Sgt. Pepper, it wasn't my favourite moment.
No.
Now listening to Sgt. Pepper, I think it is my favourite moment.
Yes.
And I think the 2017 stereo remix of Within You Without You is just a glorious...
It's a staggering thing. That you'll not be surprised that when I got the remix, that was the first song I went to.
Of course.
But I do think that is one of the tracks that benefits most from the remix.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And a lot of people talk about it as, you know, putting it with Only a Northern Song, Within You Without You, people have said it's the conscience of the album, it's the spiritual side of the album, and I think it taps into, I think the better song won.
Oh, yes.
For getting on the album, and I think it really, you know, gives George a very great status on the album.
I think on undoubtedly so. And I think the other thing, in the same way that Strawberry Fields gives you an insight into sort of where Lennon was, yes, in his mind, yes, or in his head at that particular time, this is you know, completely lays out where George is at this particular, yeah, time. The very fact that there's no other Beatle on the track, that he is completely immersed in sort of Indian music. He's just come back from, say, September. He was 66. He's in India with Ravi Shankar, learning how to hold sitar. You know, sure, that was pretty much the first lesson. He doesn't play a lot of guitar.
Yes,
on this album, most of those guitar lines on Pepper are McCartney.
Right,
Harrison really is sort of absent. Are not doing lead work, certainly on Paul's songs. And it's one of those sort of, you know, Ringo famously says, "Oh, what did you do during Sergeant Pepper? I learned how to play chess." Yeah. Both he and George have commented on the fact that it was a different way of recording. There was a lot of overdubs once they'd got those basic tracks laid down. There wasn't much for either of them to do.
Yeah.
So the flip side of that is this is George working very closely with George Martin, and I think the score for Within You Without You is really striking as, yeah, well. And again, it's this mix, in the same way that we talked, I mentioned McCartney saying, you know, you've got classical music and rock music or pop music in A Day in the Life. This is George presenting Indian music to a Western audience in a way that is,
yeah,
an easy way in.
But you're right in saying that it is his version of Strawberry Fields, because it's this balance of the intensely personal and the overwhelmingly universal, which,
yes,
is a difficult thing to pull,
yes,
off.
Yes, and it's not something, I mean, you know, George sometimes can come across as being very preachy. You know, I suppose there's an element of that in these lyrics, but I think the song as a whole, and it's a long song.
Yes.
And, you know, it opens the second side.
Yep.
So you think it's a bit of a downer.
Yeah.
You know, you flip that album over whenever you first hear it, and it's all been very up and poppy and joyous, yeah, and wonderful. And then suddenly you've got this long Indian piece. And I think it's quite striking that they chose to open the second, yep, side with that. Yeah.
And then bounce back from that, Paul does She's Leaving Home as the next song recorded, and George Martin doesn't score that. It's Mike Leander who scores it.
Yeah, and for me, one of the things that was very striking on the box set is the orchestral score.
Yeah.
I really don't like that at all.
For She's Leaving Home.
Yeah, when you hear it on its own, it is kind of sickly sweet. It's like film music. It's like, it's
very overwrought.
Yes,
yeah,
yes. But I actually, if you really kind of held my feet to the fire and said, what's the best song,
yeah,
on Sgt. Pepper, I would probably say She's Leaving Home.
Would you?
Yes.
Interesting. The other interesting thing in the box set is that little bar of music that Paul edited out at the end of every chorus.
Yes.
Which is a really strange thing. It's just these, it's like five notes. And it's a very small change, but it was the right decision to make. It's,
yeah,
very interesting.
No, what I like about She's Leaving Home is that it's, you've got Lennon and McCartney writing,
yeah,
together.
Yeah.
You know, it's a Paul song.
Yeah.
But you've got Lennon singing the sort of the counterpoint, and they did that, as I understand it, they did that live. You know, so they're just like we are today.
Mic on mic,
facing each other. And plus, it's an incredibly sensitive lyric.
Yes.
So one of my theories is that Sgt. Pepper was really the pinnacle where of the Beatles having this
cross-generational
appeal. And if you think of other songs that were being written at that time, about the generation gap, about that conflict between, you know, the parents who sort of come through the war and the teenagers that really didn't know they were well off type of attitude. No one else is writing a song as sympathetic to both sides. You know, you've got the Stones writing Mother's Little Helper. You know, it's they had taken a side.
Yes.
And that's what I think you would expect from the Stones or the Kinks or the Who, most strikingly, you know, my generation. You're taking a side and you're lining up with the kids.
And it's a song based on a true story.
Yes.
And based on a true story of someone who'd actually coincidentally met the Beatles or met Paul.
It's a weird, it's a completely weird coincidence. I mean, this is one of the things that was say that...
It's like the Eleanor Rigby grave, you know?
Yes, it's constantly throughout the Beatles' career, there are these weird coincidences that pop me up. But yeah, this was a girl, I'm trying to remember her name, Melanie Coe. And she was in the paper as having run away. You know, she was missing, but it turned out she actually had been presented with a prize in a dance competition years before.
You can't make it up.
There's a whole sort of backstory there.
And there's two songs left to be recorded for the album. So right at the end of March, they record With a Little Help from My Friends. And at the 1st of April, they record the reprise of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band for the end of the record. I think With a Little Help from My Friends kind of comes along because they don't have a Ringo song. And I think With a Little Help from My Friends might be the best Ringo Beatles song.
Yeah, I think that's... I think that's.
I think it works fantastically in the album because it introduces him as a character, as Billy Shears. It's got him interacting with the Beatles on backing vocals. He hits that fantastic high note at the end that he didn't expect to hit even himself.
Yep.
And it's a lovely song.
It is. And what if you go to the Hunter Davies biography?
Yeah.
He has a very nice little description of that song being written, where there's Paul and John are sitting in John's house, coming up with this, and they're sort of struggling over the lyric, and they're sort of soliciting contributions, and the story about the recording on the evening is that they worked sort of all through the evening to get this backing track down, and Jeff Emmerich recounts. You know, the session was finished. Ringo was trudging up the stairs to the control room. He gets about halfway up and Paul calls him back and said, no, where are you going? And he said, no, it's finished. And no, you have to come back and do the vocal. And he said Ringo was always very nervous about doing the vocal. So they sort of sprung it on him that he thought he was going to come back in the next day or the day after. And they decided, no, you're going to do this now. And he really didn't want to, but then John and George sided with Paul, and clearly they sort of all ganged up, and they were all sort of standing around, and Emmerich gives this very sort of touching description of them all standing around while he did the vocal, and Paul kind of encouraging him to go for that
big note,
that big note at the end. You know, Paul was saying they had to write in a key that was suitable for Ringo. They had to keep it within a certain range, but there is that sort of leap at the end, and they were sort of encouraging him to do it,
and he does it fantastically.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that the last two songs recorded, With a Little Help from My Friends and the short reprise of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, these are the songs that are segued to other songs in the album that kind of give it its conceptual theme, and yet they're kind of added in at the end. It's odd that you know these things weren't there. The things that make Sgt. Pepper a concept album, I think, are the fact that Sgt. Pepper goes into With a Little Help from My Friends, and the reprise goes into A Day in the Life. The other stuff is kind of academic.
I mean, it seems to be this notion of, you know, the Beatles had stopped touring, so you can go.
They sat down on day one and said, "Here's the plan.
Here's the plan. You can listen to this album, and it's like going to a gig. So you've got the overture, you hear the orchestra, and we just run through an entire concert, and there you go. And I suppose in theory they could have put applause, or they could have linked every song with applause, or faded one into the other. But I mean, it's sort of the first two songs and the last two songs really are the concept.
What make it? They're the bookends. And speaking of Ringo, his drumming is fantastic on it, his snare is fantastic on it, but on that second version of Sgt. Pepper, particularly the mono version, that intro drum and bass, and you hear in the rehearsal takes Paul say, "Give us some of that bass drum. Come on, come on, come on. It's probably the best noise that Ringo ever made, that boom, cha, that it,
yes,
right at the start.
And,
it is glorious.
It is this idea that you just had such a fantastic rhythm section in Paul and Ringo.
So what that means is, like, from the, you know, for the first 2 months, from November to the end of January, they were left with two songs for the album. And then from February, March, and at the start of just that first day of April, they get the rest of the album down. They get another 11 tracks done very, very quickly. And so all that's left is for the album to be mixed, and a tiny little extra bit of recording, the bit of nonsense at the end of the album, the run-out groove, gets recorded on the 21st of April. And that run-out groove nonsense isn't on the American Pepper.
No.
When you first listened to Pepper, were you surprised by the run-out groove, or did you know about it, or did you?
I think, from memory, I think I knew it was there.
Right.
And I do remember winding it backwards.
Did you?
Yes.
Did you hear anything naughty?
Yes.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
I haven't done that myself.
Yes. I recommend that people try. I heard somebody on a rival podcast that I'm sure
what?
No one.
There are other Beatle podcasts
that no one listens to, saying, "Oh, I wind it back," and sure enough, imagine my surprise where it says, "You know, Paul is dead," or "Paul is dead." And I think that's not what it
says.
That's
not what it
says.
It says something very naughty indeed. Apparently,
yeah.
I didn't know it was there the first time I listened to Pepper. And I had an auto lift up record player.
Okay.
Because it was the 80s, it was an upright record player as well.
Of course.
And so I'm leaning over to turn it off, thinking, well, that was a good album. And literally this blast of noise comes on for a second, and it freaked me out. it just was this, like, literally as I was touching the button, it was almost as if, say, don't touch the button. And then,
And then, of course, there is the dog whistle.
Yes, the high.
I've never heard the dog whistle. My hearing is so bad, I can't hear it.
I think I used to hear it. Now I don't hear it anymore. So that's the linear story of how the album gets recorded and put together. You know, it's not the big concept. The concept kind of evolves naturally over the 4 months or so that they are putting the album together, and this spin-off single comes out in between. But what we might do is we might press pause there for part one of our discussion on Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and we're going to do a part two where we're going to look at the album coming out and its afterlife and what does it all mean. But that's all going to happen in part two. For the moment then, we're going to sign off from Nothing Is Real. You can catch us in the usual places. We're on Twitter at BeatlesPod.
You're signing off there again. Your voice croaked as you went real.
Oh, did it? Okay.
Just do your sign off again.
So where'll I go to? But that'll be on the next episode of... Or three, two... So that'll be on the next episode of Nothing Is Real. You can catch us in all the normal places. We're on Twitter at BeatlesPod. There's a Facebook group, so do a search for us on Facebook and Stephen will let you in. And don't forget to like and subscribe and leave nice reports wherever you download your podcasts. But until the next time, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.
Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.